The Guardian.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2013 with Richard Lee.
Here in Edinburgh, there's a rich seam running through the book festival of discussion about the brain. Yesterday on the Books podcast, we were getting all emotional with Giovanni Frazzetto and Kathleen Taylor. Today, we're reflecting on memory, examining how a sense of self and identity is constructed from the stories we tell ourselves. The novelist Evie Wilde talks about how memory fuels her second novel, All the Birds Singing. She tells us how her narrator travels across the world to escape memories from her early life she's locked away. But first, we take a theoretical turn, exploring the parallels between memory and fiction with the novelist Marcel Theroux and the neuroscientist Susan Greenfield. In her essay, You and Me, Greenfield builds from the experience of consciousness to the construction of a mind, and from the mind to a sense of identity, arguing that our sense of self is inseparable from our memories, from the narrative we construct out of our lives. Theroux's novel, Strange Bodies, takes this idea a step further, imagining a procedure whereby the essence of a human being could be captured in their words. But we begin at the beginning with the mystery of consciousness itself. You're uniting C.P. Snow's two cultures single-handedly, aren't you, Susan? Appearing at the Edinburgh Festival as an expert on the mechanisms of memory and with your novel 2121, which explores how technology has divided humanity into childlike hedonists and austere logicians. But perhaps we can start back in the laboratory with your attempts to solve the mystery of consciousness. We all feel it. We're all experiencing a subjective reality right here, right now. But just what is the problem with consciousness, and why is it, as David Chalmers characterises it, the hard problem?
How do we start to confront the issue of a subjective experience delivered by something that's sludgy, that you can get under your fingernails, that occupies the same universe as nasal hair or earwax? Yeah? How do we make that water into wine conversion? And if you're a neuroscientist, it does drive you mad. I mean, it's driven me mad for many years trying to think about this. And I think what we have to do as neuroscientists, and philosophers may immediately give up on this approach, but nonetheless, is to lower our sights and say, OK, rather than trying to agonise over the water to wine question, why don't we, as neuroscientists, look and see what's going on in the brain and try and match it up, correlate, with certain subjective states. And if we could do that, if we could get a correlation, a way that reported subjectivity of different types matches up with physical events, then we might start to develop some kind of systematic relationship between the two. Now, that's not to say there's a causal relationship, but if we can relate the phenomenology to the physiology and back again, then we might have a start. And my brick in the wall, as it were, my contribution to this debate as a neuroscientist was to start by thinking, well, if you are a scientist, you always want something you can measure. And it then struck me that you can have levels or degrees of unconsciousness. It's been well known forever that you can have graded degrees of anesthesia, that sleep comes in stages. And I thought, well, if you can have graded unconsciousness, couldn't you have continuously variable consciousness? And that would fit, because then you could say that, you know, a rat would be conscious but not as conscious as a primate, and a monkey would be conscious, not as conscious as a human, and a fetus would be conscious but not as conscious as a child.
And we could be more or less conscious at different times and different states.
Exactly. Then you as an adult, even, and we, in our folklore jargon, we talk about raising our consciousness or deepening our consciousness. It doesn't matter which way you go, you know, but we're talking about degrees. And if you do that now, if you say to the neuroscientist, okay, neuroscientist, find me something in the brain that's varying in degrees from one moment to the next, then we'll have a start. And indeed, there is such a thing, which is what I call assemblies, which are highly transient coalitions of brain cells.
These are kind of across a whole brain,
yes,
sort of scale.
Yes, that work together and then stop working together on a timescale of less than a second and involving tens or hundreds of millions of brain cells. I call these assemblies. It's in my lab, that's what we work on. We image these optically in slices of brain. So we know they exist. We know they can change in degrees to various things. And I know this might sound rather mechanistic and rather unglamorous and rather crude, but at the very least, it's empirically tractable and it's a start, and that's what we're trying to do.
Our sense of self is intimately bound up with memory. Yeah. What role does these stories that we tell about ourselves play in the construction of our identity?
Well, I think that's a separate question. When we think about consciousness, I myself don't want to disenfranchise anything in the animal kingdom from being conscious. And I say if it's a continuum, you can do that. But what we can do is to say there is a difference between consciousness and self-consciousness, what philosophers call meta-representation. And that only kicks in usually in the second or third year for a human of their life. So I think I'm quite safe in saying a rat's not self-conscious. I don't think a rat looks itself in the mirror and says, I'm a rat, you know, whereas people do. Yeah. So I think that once you have that notion of self-consciousness, a notion of self distinct from others, then that's where memory plays a part, where it's not just your memory, it's how you interact, the roles you play in life. And I think the difference between, say, having a mind, which is the personalization of the brain and individual, and having an identity, is that a mind is a sort of internal passive thing. It's what you have all the time. On a desert island, you'd have a mind. On a desert island, would you have an identity? No, because an identity requires a context.
I wonder if you think at all about computers and you know, things like the Turing test. And
yes.
This is something that I was interested in my novel. And clearly people who are heavily invested in this kind of science are interested in too, that at some stage will a machine have some kind of consciousness?
Well, for the benefit of the listeners who may not know what the Turing test is, it's after the great Alan Turing, who said that you would know if a machine was conscious if you could devise a test whereby someone given impartial access to the said machine and an individual could ask any questions they liked, and if they couldn't tell which was the machine and which was the person, then that machine would have been deemed to pass the Turing test. And I gather there's been no machine that's passed the Turing test yet.
But some humans.
There's a human who's failed it. I love that idea of a human. I think I know lots of people who have failed the Turing test.
Too.
However, the best example of this, sorry to be glib, but I have to say this, that the late Stuart Sutherland, the psychologist, he said he'd believe a computer was conscious when it ran off with his wife.
But you say that the idea a computer can replicate what's going on in these bushes offends your senses as a neuroscientist.
Yes, in particular, I'll name names here, why not? Ray Kurzweil, who's a great proponent, you may be familiar with the singularity, where he's a great fan of computational abilities. And he says that this is screeching ahead at such an exponential rate. Sooner or later, we'll just be kind of household pets, you know, if we're lucky.
His idea is that at some stage that technological development will be so fast that it will be sort of exponential, and 10,000 years of scientific progress will happen
in an
afternoon, and he'll be uploading his consciousness onto an optical disk.
The problem I have with that, with this notion that the brain works computationally, is I think it's wrong. As the great Bohr said to someone once, said, you're not thinking, you're just being logical. And Rod Penrose, a brilliant mathematician, says there is no algorithm for common sense and intuition, all of which drive science, not just arts subjects, but drive science.
And I wonder what you'd make of your idea in your novel, Strange Bodies, Marcel, of the procedure.
I was interested in the thing that Milton said in the introduction to Areopagitica. He said, books are not absolutely dead things, but do contain, as in a vial, the purest efficacy of the living intellect that bred them. So the idea is that books clearly don't have consciousness, but they occupy this weird in-between state, that they don't come alive until they have a reader.
That touches a little bit on quantum theory, where the very nature of the observation determines what you're actually observing.
Yeah. But also, as a reader and an author yourself, you know that when there's a book you love, that there's a kind of echo of the author that gets set up in your brain and that you can carry with you for a very long time.
So go on, tell us about the procedure. How do you bring Nikki Slocum back to life?
Well, so in my novel, I kind of formalise this relationship between a reader and a book, and I attribute it to a secret Soviet scientific tradition, which actually, there's a grain of truth in it. But the idea is that a consciousness can be derived from some of its external traces and reconstituted in this new person.
But in particular, by the things they've written down, and there's a kind of limit. You've got a 100,000 word limit.
I mean, these are all arbitrary, and I was having fun with this stuff, but
In a sense, I mean, I don't know if I would attribute consciousness to the thing that's on the outside, but I certainly think that the relationship between an object and the brain does create a special relationship. Take, for example, you're both wearing wedding rings, okay?
Yes.
Yeah, so I don't have to check exactly. So let's be brutal. Wedding rings are pretty generic, a small baby would be attracted to them, possibly, because they're gold, they're shiny. If you put one on the table, they might want to put it in their mouth, they'll roll it. I mean, as an object, its sensory properties are, quite attention-grabbing in a certain sense. And it's only as the weeks turn to months and as the brain cell connections, as we know, personalise and form around whatever experience you're having, the child will learn that this is something that goes on fingers. And then they'll learn that something that looks like that only goes on a certain finger and only under certain circumstances it has with it lots of associations. Mm. Dare I say baggage. Right? Then as they grow, they get one of their own, possibly. And that thing of their own might be the most important thing in their life. And then if they go, let's say, sadly, from the honeymoon to the divorce, their attitude to it may change. And this thing that was possibly the most important thing in their life, the thing that perhaps, you know, made them burst into tears when the divorce, they took it off, a child would just put in its mouth. And the difference is not in the object. Mm. It's what goes
it's
on.
It's relational.
The wonderful thing about being human, especially, is you personalize objects and people and events around you. So we say that you go from the purely sensory to the cognitive.
Mm. There's a book called Daniel Dennett. Understanding Consciousness.
Consciousness Explained.
Having read half of it, I would say slightly.
You want your money back?
I totally don't feel any closer to understanding what it is.
Let me ask you both a killer question then, and this is something that does keep me awake at night, and could inspire a novel. And in fact, Fred, the character of mine, struggles with this question all the time, and he doesn't answer it in case anyone thinks they're going to get an easy answer, which is, let's say I said to you both, Richard Marcel, in my way to the studio just now, I suddenly realized how the brain generated consciousness. I now know. Yeah. What would you expect me to show you? Would it be a performing rat? Would it be a brain scan? Would it be you suddenly feel like me? What kind of answer? Given infinite resources, infinite possibilities, infinite everything, I've yet to meet someone who's even in the most science fiction realm or the most phantasmagorical or abstract or vague way said, well, the kind of thing you'd need to show is this. We have to come up with a sequence of events that says, well, first of all, you have this brain, and then you have these chemicals released, and then you have this, then you have consciousness.
The hard problem no longer mysterious.
That's right. The hard problem is this is the sequence of events, and then we get to there. Yeah.
It's a challenge. It seems to me that human personalities, like as Nikki argues in your novel, are neither stable nor discrete, but embedded and constructed from other things like history, societies and cultures, which is a bit like a novel itself. Is that why the novel is such a good way of exploring these issues?
I think poems and novels are a great way of having someone else's consciousness temporarily. And that's what I was saying. Yeah. I mean, that's what happens when you read a book is so mysterious. A book can make you change your mind. Yeah. A book can make you fall in love. A book can make you want to go to war.
People are a bit baffled. They say, well, you're a scientist, so why write a novel? What's the difference? And the difference is that the novel actually takes on the big questions of what is individuality, what is a mind, how is one person different from another, how do they relate to each other, what makes someone happy, what is freedom and free will. And so, and those big themes I thought were very exciting for me as a scientist to explore through the prism of neuroscience. But the neuroscience is really just the prism. What I was really interested in, and the reason I wanted to write a novel as opposed to yet another scientific paper, was I wanted to just think about these things through the different characters and how they related to each other. As someone said, you can have a public life and you have a private life, but also you have a secret life. And that secret life is the one that perhaps is the most exciting and the one that you don't necessarily know. You might have a little bit in novels. You might, if you have a first-person narrative, you might. And actually, I did write another book called You and Me, The Neuroscience of Identity in 2011, which suggests that there's force. First, you have to be conscious, then you have to have a mind. You see the world in a certain way. But then you have to react to the world. But then you have to react back.
Just that your identity is anyway somewhat fictional. I mean, it's composed by experiences you have. It could be...
Well, I think in the long term, what happens is that you have all these different episodes, and you can be a father, you can be a husband, you can be the goalkeeper, you can be the boss and so on. All those different things, different times of day. But what you have is your memory, which somehow creates a narrative of all those different things. And there's different dimensions too. You can be very different with your parents as you would be at a party, obviously.
And this is why dementia is so incredibly upsetting to the people around, because it's like losing someone.
In Strange Bodies, Vera suggests that there's something inherently linguistic about this kind of sense of self. I mean, does that stack up against the evidence?
What's very interesting is the average kids start speaking properly at about 3. And when they start using pronouns, that's when memories start to stick.
What I felt like instinctively, that when you have and your memories
are
here to your sense of I.
Because as soon as you have a pronoun of I, that's why I said you and me, as soon as that happens, then it's much easier to have episodes. That's not to say that people don't have kind of hazy memories, like animals have hazy, but episodic memory, where you are very clearly delineated from someone else, it usually comes with language.
And you construct
when you have a word to stand for something like yourself.
And you construct those memories in words, and that contributes to your identity. And a lot of times when people feel that their identities are failing and their stories aren't good enough, they go to therapists and they come up with they work on their stories. They find better stories to tell their life.
Words are so important, and I do fear the demise of reading and writing and books and so on, is if you think about it, what's the difference between a raw emotion, a feeling, yeah, and a thought? And here's my suggestion. A raw feeling, which the tail wagging dog or the cat purring or the gurgly baby will exhibit, it's just there, it's in the moment. A thought, now it could be a memory, a business plan, a hope, a grievance, a logical argument, they all have one thing in common. They all have a beginning, a middle, and an end, a linear sequence. Mm. Yeah. So you end up in a different place when you have a thought, in the way you don't when you have a raw emotion. Having language aids and abets thought in a hugely valuable way.
Yeah, you're almost arguing like Daniel Dennett here when he says that the thing is that the thing that is you, the person that you play, is your centre of narrative gravity. It's not so much that we, using our brains, spin our yarns, as that our brains, using yarns, using fiction, spin us.
Yeah, that's why I think fiction informs more than informs fact, actually, and why its stories are so compelling. You know, there's so much in our human nature. The most magic thing, if you say, once upon a time.
I mean, in Eastern mystical traditions, the highest state of consciousness would be post-verbal, where you would have got rid of the chattering monkey mind and reached a kind of...
So the way I see that is as a continuum. Let's see, take that continuum. The most simplistic form of consciousness, let's say of an infant or a non-human animal, is one that's entirely driven by the senses from the outside. You know, you're distracted by the next thing, by the
dog
next
barks,
thing. Well, you know, a child cries and you say, look at the bird, you know. Most of the time, most of us are interactive. You know, you have your own inner thoughts about wedding rings or whatever, and you react to the outside world, and it's a whole balance. Whereas meditation is the extreme, where you shut out the outside world entirely because you have the power for self-driven thoughts and so on. And I think that you can see a continuum of consciousness, with the deepest consciousness, let's say, being meditation, and the most shallow being that of the infant or the non-human animal, as a function of the degree to which you're interacting or being dominated by the external world.
Susan Greenfield's You and Me is published by Notting Hill Editions, and Marcel Theroux's Strange Bodies by Faber. The narrator of Evie Wilde's All the Birds Singing isn't so much shutting herself off from the outside world as walling herself off from her inner life. She began by reading from the novel.
So this is an extract where the main character, Jake, is living with a woman called Karen, and they're both working the streets together. And Jake has just woken up from a nightmare, and Karen's trying to calm her down. Think of your brain, Karen tells me. Visualise it. I can hear her breathing deeply in the dark, and it's nice. Can you see it? She asks. OK, I say. My brain is neon pink and bulging. See the cleft that runs down the middle, that separates your brain into two halves? I do. I zoom in on the line in my head. Think of it, says Karen. That line is the corridor of your brain. My imagined brain doesn't know what to do, so it just pulsates. Either side of the corridor, she goes on, and she starts to stroke my hair with the hand that's scooped around my back, are the rooms with the memories in. Her voice has dropped a bit, and coupled with her breathing in and out, like the feeling of lying in the bottom of a boat in a gentle swell, it's easier to see the brain corridor. It's lit with halogen bulbs, and the floor is shiny like a hospital corridor. No one's in it, and it stretches on until it disappears out of sight. Karen starts to stroke my hair behind my ear again and again. Go in through one of those doors, she says. I reach out, and when I look down, I'm dressed in an old-fashioned nursing outfit. My shoes are rubber-soled. I turn the door handle and step inside, where I see the bathroom back home, with a little knot of wood that I can push out to watch Iris, but it is plugged with loo roll. Outside, it's daytime, but also black. I can smell the world around me melting. I can smell the oil in the deep fat fryer from downstairs. I hear a tinkle of glass breaking. And now step out of that room via the door you went in through, says Karen. And I turn around, and the hospital door is still there, hasn't closed up while I wasn't looking. And I step my rubber-soled foot through it and into the dim-lit corridor. And now close the door behind you and lock it. I take a large ring of keys from my crisp white pocket, and it jangles as I lock the door. And now walk down the corridor, says Karen. And her fingers have started to slide deeper into my hair, stroking slowly in time with her breath, and she has slid down a little lower so that I feel her breath in my hair and it feels like hot bread. And choose a new door, open it and go in. Go into a good place. And if it turns into a bad room, leave and find a new door. I stand at the door with my keys in my hand. I can see my reflection in the safety glass. There's one of those little paper hats with the red cross on my head. Through the window, I can see the room is underwater and something noses at the glass, but the water is dark and I can't quite make out what it is. I stand in the corridor with my neat white shoes close together. Are you in that room? Is it a good room? Asks Karen quietly. Yes, I lie, matching her voice. I stay standing in the corridor a moment longer, and then I carry on walking down it. It stretches as far as I can see, and I may never have to go inside another room.
Memory is a very powerful force in this novel, isn't it?
I'm interested in what happens when you wad memories down, when there are unwanted things. In the book, there's a lot about ways of not remembering things.
Yeah, Jake has kind of explicitly locked down her memories, hasn't she? Exactly. She's put them somewhere where she doesn't have to go.
Yeah, I used to have bad nightmares as a kid, and my mother used to tell me to do this odd thing with my brain to get rid of those memories. And I think, to a certain extent, it sort of works in that you can keep your brain kind of free of your mind, in a way. And I'm interested in that and what you hide from yourself and also how you forgive yourself if you've done something bad and there's no human forgiveness that's possible. And if you're not religious, if you can't kind of find it in yourself to find a God to say you're reborn or whatever, how you come to terms with that.
Yeah, having put these memories away, having locked them aside, how you come to some sort of accommodation with
them.
Yeah. Because it's also, it's not just Jake, is it? Lloyd is on a is on the last stop of a journey to remember, but he can't get it right. He's kind of sick of it as well. And then there's Don, whose memories were enough to almost drive him to destruction as well.
While I was writing it, my father was very sick and died while I was three quarters of the way through it. And I think that brought an element of remembrance to the book. I think it started to interest me the different ways that you could remember a person that weren't necessarily the term grief and mourning are very strange things, because when you get there, you're not actually sure what they are. And so I was interested in physical ways of remembering and, you know, libation and stuff like that. It seemed like an interesting path.
The novel is split into two layers. The first layer charts a season on Jake's cold, wet sheep farm on an unnamed British island. And then the second layer unspools backwards, unpacking an earlier stage of her life in Australia. What's the attraction of telling half the story in reverse?
I'd written about half of it, and I kind of knew the arc of the story, but I just found that it needed to be told in a different way, to feel like it was memory, to be effective, I suppose. I mean, after the first book, which is two strands in different times, I was quite firm that I wanted to start at the beginning and work through to the end, and it was going to be simple and linear. But I was quite disappointed at the point where I realised it was going to have to fold over. And then it sort of turned into more or less a maths problem towards the end, which I think helps you distance yourself a little bit from it and maybe helps with the writing.
Yeah, I mean, there's not just the question of suspense, of kind of gradually wondering what the terrible event is going to turn out to be, but it's also it's a question of giving the reader that experience, as Jake is doing, of stripping away the layers that she's put aside. Was that?
Yeah. I think one of the things I'm really interested in is the little jumps that the reader has to make. So, you know, everyone will read the same book and have different pictures in their head. You know, the characters will look different. It will be set somewhere different. And I think there's something interesting about the gaps you leave and what fills them, a bit like silences in music, that sort of thing.
There's also the question of sympathy as well. I mean, the reader first goes through the kind of awful consequences of Jake's misfortunes, but feels them really all the way through, and so is prepared maybe to understand or prepared to forgive. It was forgiveness, again, another thing you're looking for.
Yeah, I think we've all got stuff that we feel is unforgivable that we've done. And I suppose it's kind of, in a way, an exercise at looking at, you know, even the really sort of despicable characters in the book. I feel some sympathy for, you know, Otto. He wasn't always a creepy old guy murdering sheep in the middle of nowhere. So I sort of wanted to imply backstories to everyone, even the bad characters.
Yeah, yeah. In your acknowledgements, you thank some sheep farmers who you say let you watch them working. Do you kind of take notes and pictures or so when you're doing that kind of field work, or do you rely on your own memory?
I take some notes for, you know, really specific things like how many grams of grain, that sort of thing. But the way I tend to work is I will write my idea of what it's like working on a sheep farm, having no knowledge of it, but just imagining. And then I'll check that against the reality of it. Otherwise, I find I get sort of stalled, and there's a danger of finding something really interesting out and really specific and wanting to work it into your work, and it's useless.
And what about your time in Australia? Are you drawing on a kind of finite well of Australian memory?
Well, I go back fairly often, so to refill the well. But I think childhood memories seem to be where I start from, whether it's an overheard conversation of adults when I was a child or a sort of sensory memory of a smell or something. And in Australia, the light is so vivid and the colours. And I think they have sort of left a real imprint on me, those memories.
As well as the gaps that you've left in the story, there are also phrases or images which toll through the novel, like the human eye senses movement before all else, the severed feet, or the Devon cream tea, indeed. How much are you depending on your reader's memory?
I feel that it doesn't matter if they don't pick it up. I don't think all that much about the reader when I'm writing. I'm thinking totally selfishly about what I'm enjoying doing, and I like leaving traces of things that some people will pick up and some people won't, you know, like those, what was that book, What a Mess, the dog, and there were little ladybirds and things that some people saw and some people didn't, you know. It's fun and it's playful and yeah, it makes it really enjoyable.
It's to keep your own interest up, almost.
Yeah, almost. But
how much do you rely on your own memory? Do you check back to what you were writing, you know, 6 months ago to say, oh, was it...
I mean, I'm a very slow reader, so I will kind of reread, but in the process of rereading, I'm rewriting. But yeah, it certainly doesn't happen from the start to the finish. I tend to start somewhere in the middle of the book and work outwards both ways.
Mm. I'm wondering what it is about the novel that makes it so particularly suited to exploring these kind of questions of our memories and our forgetting, how we recreate ourselves in function of the stories we remember.
I mean, I wonder if it's just the amount of space that you have in a novel, the amount of time. Both my books have taken about 3.5 years, and during that time there have been long periods of not writing but of just thinking on the subject and sort of meditating on, you know, how best to remember a sheep, things like that. And I don't know, I think it's just giving you that space.
Well, we've run out of space for another edition. Evie Wilde's All the Birds Singing is published by Jonathan Cape. Thanks to her, Susan Greenfield and Marcel Theroux. We'll be back with more from the Book Festival tomorrow. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast to listen online, follow us on SoundCloud or subscribe via iTunes. Until then, from me, Richard Lee, and producer Tim Mabey, thanks for listening.
The Books Podcast from guardian.co.uk.